If Prop 209 is enacted, it will eliminate all of those tried, true, and tested rules and regulations and efforts generated mostly by people of goodwill to do something about making sure that San Francisco State University, University of California, the contracting process, the employment process in the state system offers an equal opportunity to those who have been denied that opportunity because of race or gender.
Former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown, during a 1996 debate on Proposition 209, the initiative that ended affirmative action in the state of California. But this November, voters will have the chance to repeal that decision with Proposition 16. The arguments for and against Prop 16 are the same arguments you typically hear about affirmative action. Opponents say it's reverse discrimination and that no one should get special treatment. Supporters say it's necessary to even the playing field for women and people of color. Joining us to talk about Prop 16 is Katie Orr, politics and government reporter for KQED. She's based in Sacramento. Welcome back to Press Play, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get a quick history lesson first before we get into this year's initiative. Take us back to 1996 when voters approved Prop 209. What was the rhetoric at the time around this proposition?
Yeah, Prop 209 was one of several measures that was championed by then Governor Pete Wilson. And it was actually a lot of like what we're seeing on the national level from Republicans these days, a lot of talk about immigrants coming in and taking over people's jobs and their way of life and, you know, getting benefits that they didn't deserve, things like that. And so Prop 209 was really based on those arguments as well. It was, you know, seen as a way that people, you know, could succeed and in mostly the University of California and not have people who they maybe didn't think were quote unquote deserving getting into those schools based on their race, basically.
Mm-hmm. And did it pass by a landslide or not?
I think it passed. I don't know the exact numbers, but it passed pretty confidently. And supporters of affirmative action have been trying to overturn Prop 209 or at least modify it for, you know, 25 years almost, ever since it passed, basically. And they have not been successful with that. So this is their latest attempt. They're hoping that because of the national conversation that we've been having on race and social justice, the timing might be right to finally overturn this proposition. However, it does seem like it is still struggling with voters. They're not really making the connection.
Well, why is that? Because the demographics of California have changed a lot in the last quarter century. We're now a majority minority state. There are a lot more people of color in positions of power in the state legislature. And so why wouldn't more people support this initiative?
You know, supporters of Prop 16 will tell you once people get educated on what exactly it does, they do come over to the yes side. But that is an issue. You know, we're just a couple weeks out from the election. People are already voting. And, you know, to have to go and explain a proposition in detail to 40 million people, I mean, you know, that's the population of California, is a tough, is a tough sell. And I think I spoke with a professor at UC Berkeley who was saying that people in their minds don't believe there's anything wrong with the system. You know, they look at UC Berkeley or, you know, UCLA, our universities, and say they are diverse. And a lot of that is because, as you mentioned, the just the makeup of our population is changing. So it's hard to convince people that, one, there's a problem, and two, this is the right way to fix it.
Well, what is the research on what happened after Prop 209 passed and admissions to the UC system?
Well, I should say that there has been a lot of research done on both sides. One study that has gotten a lot of attention recently was commissioned by the University of California Office of the President. And this study was noted because it looked at the effects of Prop 209, not just on graduation rates, but also what happens like on a broader spectrum. And it found that Black and Brown students under Prop 209 suffered more, because what would happen is if, let's say, a Black student didn't get into UC Berkeley, then that would bump them down maybe to like UC Irvine, but that would bump another Black or Brown student down, and on and on and on, until you had students basically just falling off the rung and not going to higher education. They also found that there was a significant effect on these students' income in later years, because they didn't get that higher degree, their income wasn't as high. And the study also found that there are negative effects for like white and Asian students who might, you know, lose a spot to a Black or Brown student, but those students are more able to make up, you know, make up the difference. They're not as hurt. They're not hurt as badly. For instance, if they don't go to a UC Berkeley, maybe they go to UCLA, or maybe they go to Stanford, you know, and their life isn't as affected. But I should say there is research on the other side that kind of debates this. There was a researcher from UCLA, a professor from UCLA, who did his own study that said, you know, he found that racial minorities have prospered under Prop 209, that it's forced UC campuses to invest more in academic prep and raise their graduation rates and find other ways to be inclusive. So it's, you know, it's one of those issues that has been studied a lot, and there are arguments on both sides.
But as far as I can tell by just reading the language of the proposition, it doesn't require affirmative action. It just says it may be used, right? So it wouldn't force institutions to use affirmative action.
Right. That is true. Opponents of Prop 16 maintain, though, that once you give like universities the opportunity to include race, then that is the overriding factor that they will consider, that they won't take into account neighborhoods and, you know, academics and all stuff like that as much as they will consider race.
And so is there a lot of money going into this on both sides or not?
Well, there is a lot of money, but it's very lopsided. The supporters of Prop 16 have raised close to, they've raised as of today about $19.6 million. The opponents have only raised $1.1 million. But what is interesting is that the opponents, even though they've raised far less, have thousands more contributors. They have about 3,000 contributors compared to the supporters, who have just over 600. So you have fewer people giving a lot of money to the yes side versus, you know, more people giving lesser amounts to the no side. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out on election day. As I mentioned, you know, we're getting pretty close, and I've started to see a little bit more support Prop 16 ads, but I feel like with that kind of money, they got to get out there and spend it. They don't have too much longer to wait.
Yeah, it's interesting that despite the spending advantage, they are not doing well in the polls, and it looks like this proposition is on the way to failure.
I mean, the other thing that supporters of Prop 16 will tell you is that these polls talk to likely voters. And because of the huge voter turnout that we're expected to see this election cycle, they are counting on the likely voters to be kind of skewed, you know, that these polls aren't capturing people who haven't voted before and perhaps are more likely to support Prop 16 than those people who are talked to in surveys.
Well, Katie, thank you.
You're welcome.
Katie Orr is a politics and government reporter for KQED. She's based in Sacramento. All right, another ballot initiative that is asking you to undo another decades-old initiative, Prop 13, or at least one part of it. Decades ago, voters permanently tied property taxes to the purchase price of homes and commercial property. This year's Prop 15 would tweak that by removing that protection from some commercial properties. Both sides are well-funded. with tens of millions of dollars spent for and against. Business leaders, teachers, even Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg are all getting in on the spending action. We're going to follow the money now with Ben Christopher. He covers California politics and elections for CalMatters. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right, first, explain this proposition, Prop 15. It is always referred to as the split roll initiative, which is kind of eye glazing. But in general, what would this do?
Sure. So sort of the big picture question is whether voters want to raise property taxes on large and medium sized businesses in order to raise what would be billions of dollars in between $6 and $11.5 billion for local governments and schools. But to sort of understand how this works in practice, you do have to kind of get into this the weeds of this other very contentious property tax measure from 1978, which you mentioned, Prop 13. And so Prop 13, as you mentioned, it capped property taxes across the state. And the main way it did that was by setting property taxes based on how much a property was purchased for rather than its current market value, which is unusual. Most states, I think maybe every other state doesn't do it that way. And so what that means is that the longer that someone owns a piece of property, assuming that property values go up and up, which in California is a safe bet, the bigger the tax break they get. And it's a tax break that applies to both homeowners, but also commercial and industrial property owners. And so what Prop 15 would do this year is to take that tax break away from business property owners with some exceptions.
So this wouldn't touch residential property, only commercial property.
Right. If you're a homeowner, you would retain the Prop 13 protection.
Is it all commercial property or is there a minimum amount?
Yeah, there are some key exemptions. And so the biggest one is what the proponents of Prop 15 call a small business exemption, which the proposition defines as any property owner that owns less than $3 million worth of property in California. And so, you know, I've heard from some readers from, you know, Beverly Hills or San Francisco saying $3 million, that's nothing. But so depending on where you are, whether you're in Beverly Hills or Fresno, that might mean very different things. But essentially, if you are within this small business exemption, you would be able to keep your Prop 13 protection.
But for everyone else, it would be your rates would go up to the current fair market value immediately.
Right. Right. Which it could be a lot. It could be a little. It kind of depends on the last time that the property was assessed. And so if say you own a big store in California right now, you pay your property taxes based on however much that store was purchased for. And so if you purchased the store last year, then you're not really going to see a property tax increase. But if you purchased it in 1980 and Prop 15 passes, then the store is going to be reassessed to that new market value, which could be a very large increase.
Right. But that kind of changes now that we're in a pandemic, right? I mean, I wonder if these businesses are thinking, look, this is the last thing we need. We're barely hanging on. And if you increase our property taxes, that's it for us.
Oh, they're definitely thinking that. And you hear them loud and clear on that point. Exactly. They're saying, look, we're in the middle of a pandemic and it's already, you know, California already has fairly high business costs. So is this really what we need? On the other hand, from the proponents, you also see sort of the shifting political rhetoric around the pandemic saying, hey, look at schools, look at local governments. They are being financially gutted. They could really use some extra funding right now.
And why is Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook getting involved in this?
That is such a good question. So the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative is this, it's actually a private company that was set up by Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Priscilla Chan. But it sort of operates as this philanthropic organization that contributes to various initiatives. And they have actually, they are one of the top funders for Proposition 15. It's sort of unusual because for the most part, this is a standoff between organized labor and progressive groups and business groups who really don't want to see Proposition 15 passed. But the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative is one exception to that rule. And, you know, it's sort of unclear exactly why. I mean, if you ask them, it's because they believe that this is good policy. And it does maybe align with the fact that Silicon Valley tends to be a bit more liberal, at least on some issues. And Mark Zuckerberg himself is kind of hard to pinpoint politically sometimes. But I think, you know, there's the belief that this would be very helpful to raise all this additional funding for schools and local governments. But I think there's also a context here, which is that, again, because if Prop 15 passes, it would raise property taxes, particularly on businesses that have been sitting on property for decades. And if you are in the tech sector, particularly if you're, you know, Facebook or Salesforce, you actually haven't been sitting on your, you haven't been owning your campus for all that long. And so actually there's an argument to be made that, that perhaps they don't have as much to lose if Prop 15 passes.
Aha. Okay. So Zuckerberg is involved. That means money is involved. How much money on both sides are we talking about?
So on the yes side, we have about $54 million. A lot of that money is coming from organized labor. So you have about $15 million coming from the SEIU, that's the Service Employees International Union. You have another $12 million or so coming from the California Teachers Association, that's the teachers union. And then from the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, there's another $14 million coming in. And then on the no side, that's almost entirely coming from large business organizations. So the California Business Roundtable, which is sort of this industry group for the state's big businesses, they've pitched in $26 million. So that's where the bulk of the money on the no side is coming from. And you also have the California Business Property Association, which is sort of a trade group for large property owners. Obviously, they, you know, don't love the idea of paying much higher property taxes. So that's where their opposition is coming from as well.
There's another proposition on the ballot, Prop 19. This is all very confusing, I know. But this would also tweak property tax laws. It's tangentially related in that it would affect older homeowners, and they could transfer their property tax base, the presumably low rate that they have because they've been living in their homes forever, to a new property if they move. So is that the essential reading of this proposition, Prop 19?
Yeah, I mean, so what makes this a little bit complicated is that it's sort of the Frankenstein's monster of propositions, in the sense that the main issue is the one that you just described, where it would provide this tax break to sort of particularly empty nesters, older homeowners, homeowners who are permanently disabled, homeowners who have been the victims of natural disaster, and it would allow them to sell their home and move to a new one without having to take this really large tax increase, because they'd have to pay a property tax based on the new, probably higher property tax. So that's sort of the main provision. And it's something that actually the California realtors have been pushing for a really long time. And so this year, they're putting this measure back on the ballot, but they've added a few sort of sweeteners to the deal. So there's also the second provision that would increase property taxes on people who inherit homes, particularly if they inherit homes that they don't use as their permanent residence. And in fact, there was this story in the Los Angeles Times a couple of years ago that pointed out that Jeff Bridges, the actor, was taking advantage of this tax break. And so sometimes you hear this called the Lebowski loophole. So it would close the Lebowski loophole. And then it would also throw a bunch of – and any difference that the proposition raises between this tax break and this tax increase, which is estimated to be about $1 billion, that would go to wildfire fighting. And so these extra goodies were added in order to get the Democratic Party on board, in order to get the firefighters on board. And so now you have this sort of like Frankenstein's monster of these three very, you know, sort of related policy proposals that have just kind of been grafted onto each other. And that's how we have Prop 19.
Oh, my gosh. Well, OK, so Prop 19, Prop 15, both an attempt to reimagine Prop 13 from 1978. So interesting that we're still fighting this battle, lo these many decades later.
Yeah, it's the forever battle in California politics for sure.
Ben Christopher from CalMatters, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, we hope that we have provided some clarity for you as you face your ballot and all the decisions that you're being asked to make in this democracy. And that's part of it. We are trying to provide you with unbiased information to help you become a more engaged citizen. And so it's like a handshake. And that's kind of how it works here. We can't do it without you. We can't do it without your support. And we come to you just a couple times during the year, very short little pitch breaks, because we don't want to take away from the programming, to ask you to go online at kcrw.com/join. We have an added incentive today. You can be entered to win a brand new 13-inch MacBook Air. So that's in the offing as well. Just go online and check out all the details. And thank you so much for supporting your public radio station at kcrw.com/join. Coming up, how teenagers are faring in lockdown. A new study finds that from a mental health perspective, they haven't suffered as much as we thought. In fact, some are actually doing better than they were a year ago. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, we know that adults are feeling more depressed and anxious these days during COVID. CDC data says anxiety tripled compared to the last 2 years. Depression quadrupled. But here's a surprising piece of information. The kids might be all right, or at least a little bit better. According to some new research, the percentage of teenagers experiencing depression is actually lower in 2020 than it was pre-COVID. Apparently, more sleep and more family time is having a positive effect. Jean Twenge is a psychology professor at San Diego State University and author of the book, iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. And she's part of the team of scientists that looked into how teens were handling the effects of the pandemic. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Well, talk to me about these trends. What was the most surprising finding?
Well, we were able to compare the sample of teens from May, June, and July of 2020 with a demographically similar sample of teens from 2018. And I was the one who took the first look at that data, and I was really surprised to see that the teens in 2020 were doing just as well, and in some cases even a little better in terms of depression and loneliness. They were a little less happy and a little less satisfied with their lives, but overall, this is a pretty good and surprisingly good, really, outcome.
So that is surprising, given what I just said about adults. And what do you think is the reason for that?
Well, I think sleep is an enormous part of it. So we were able to compare rates of sleep. And the percentage of teens who said that they were getting 7 or more hours of sleep just shot upward in 2020. Because when they're going to physical school, a lot of high schools start very early, you know, 7, 7:30. Even if they start at 8, they have to get on the bus or, you know, have a drive to school, sometimes in traffic. And they often have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, which is exactly counter to their body clock when they're adolescents. With the pandemic, that stopped. They didn't have the commute. Their schools often started a little bit later. They got to finally get the sleep that they need. And not getting enough sleep is a major risk factor for depression and anxiety and mental health issues. So I think that really helped them.
Well, I guess that is not surprising. Better sleep makes us all feel a lot better. But also, I think another thing that is surprising is that you and many others have reported that being online has contributed to depression and anxiety. And so I'm assuming that kids, teenagers like all of us, are online more now than we have been. So why didn't that counteract the benefits of sleep and increase anxiety and depression among teens?
Well, it's absolutely true that teens were online for school more than they were in the past. However, they weren't necessarily spending that much more time online during their free time. In fact, they actually spent less time on social media in 2020 than they did in 2018. So it turns out, you know, social media is much more linked to depression than, say, watching TV or videos or, you know, doing FaceTime or Zoom with friends in real time, which is often have benefits for mental health. So they were making smart choices about the time they were spending online and how they were using it.
So less time on social media, even though they weren't seeing their friends, that is counterintuitive because I would assume that they would spend more time trying to connect with their friends on social media if they couldn't see them in person.
I think they replaced it with other venues. So some of it is probably due to doing video chat and Zoom. Some of it may also be due to the popularity of TikTok, which is more of a video platform. It's kind of a hybrid of social media and video, but that's really surged in popularity recently and may have been something that might have replaced some of the social media time.
Oh, so TikTok actually has a beneficial effect on mental health, you're surmising?
I am not necessarily suggesting that. however, it does mean that their time moved from social media to video. And, it's a really great question to ask, hey, what does it look like if you spend an hour on Instagram versus an hour on TikTok in terms of the relation to mental health? And we just don't know right now.
Well, I mean, I know just anecdotally that a lot of people really enjoy TikTok and find it a nice release to just veg out and watch some of these goofy videos. So maybe that could be part of it. I don't know.
Yeah. Yes, it has a sense of humor. I mean, in general, at a broad level, people who spend a lot of time watching TV and videos are not as likely to be depressed as those who spend the same amount of time on social media.
Does this go, is this the same thing for adults? Does this remain true across age groups?
You mean in terms of mental health?
Uh-huh.
So we do find in, there's government data on this as well as other surveys, that the mental health effects in the pandemic hit adults a lot harder, particularly young adults. And I think a lot of that has to do with economic impacts, that the biggest economic impacts were on young adults, often those in their 20s. And if you're supporting yourself and you lose that job, obviously that's an enormous source of stress and can easily lead to anxiety and depression. For teens, even though some of their families did experience these economic disruptions, it wasn't on their shoulders. It wasn't as much their responsibility. And they had more economic stability because, of course, most of their parents are more like in their 40s and 50s and were less likely to have lost a job.
Right. Did you sample a broad range in your in the demographics of teens?
We did. We got a nationally representative sample that matched the 2018 data, which was from a government-funded survey that gets a broad cross-section across region, race and ethnicity, gender, et cetera.
And what about spending more time with family members? That can be a boon and a bane, I think, at the same time, right? Maybe a little much too much togetherness can cause friction, but then maybe families are forging stronger bonds.
And that's what we found. You know, the majority of teens said that they felt closer to their families now than they did before the pandemic. There was also an uptick in the numbers said they had more family dinners, that they went on walks, did things with their families more than they used to. And I mean, it's the classic thing of it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. So, yeah, we're getting all on each other's nerves, but we're spending a lot of time together as a family. We're not running around doing lots of activities, other things. Your parents were more likely to be home and not commuting. So there was more time to spend with family, and there were some upsides to that. It was a little bit of a silver lining during the pandemic and still is.
And do you expect once we get out of this for things to go back to the way they were, or will some of these habits stick?
That remains to be seen. I think, the sleep piece is going to continue to be an issue for teens. The good news is we have that California law on the horizon in about 2 years that has mandated that high schools start at 8:30 a.m. or later. Of course, it wouldn't shock me, though, if there ends up being resistance or that doesn't get implemented. Given these results and all of the other research that we have on how important sleep is, I really hope that it does get implemented, because then maybe we could stem some of this tide of the rise in teen depression that started around 2012 and has continued to get worse through 2018.
Psychology professor Jean Twenge studies mental health in Gen Z, and her book is called iGen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, local breweries can reopen now, but under strict rules.
Whether it's Angel City, whether it's Frogtown, you have to get online and make a 24-hour reservation before you go in there.
What it takes to get a beer these days, that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Breweries and wineries here in LA County recently got the green light to open back up. But That green light comes with a lot of red tape. The county has issued a bunch of restrictions on how breweries and wineries can operate now, and some places aren't sure how they're going to make it work. Meanwhile, bars are still closed. Here to give us a rundown of exactly what we have to do to get a good drink around here is Melissa Hidalgo. She writes the Dr. Beer Butch column for LA Taco. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back. Why are breweries and wineries allowed to reopen, but bars are not?
I spoke to a lot of co-owners, brewers, workers from a good selection of breweries yesterday. And the number one reason, according to the health department, why bars are not still allowed to open is due mainly because of the closed indoor quarters, right? The idea that people are going to go drink and mingle. Now, part of the problem is that for breweries, a lot of which are, you know, either outdoors or in industrial areas or, you know, have restaurants attached, the county tended to conflate breweries with bars, kind of letting them know that, you know, you guys are the same, you know, you're going to promote mingling, you're going to promote drunk people that aren't going to pay attention to the regulations so much. And so for a while, that this is why breweries and wineries weren't able to open for a long time. Now, part of the reason why breweries and not bars are open is because I'm pretty sure it has to do with the lobbying that the LA Brewers Guild did in front of the LA County Board of Supervisors, who made the ultimate decision. From what I hear, it just happened a few days ago, allowing breweries to open as long as they are able to serve food somehow.
So you have to be able to order food in order to get a beer at one of these breweries.
Yes. This, as you can imagine, you know, a lot of the breweries that are members of the LA Brewers Guild, I think only about 20 or 25 of them have restaurants attached. So they were not impacted in the same way as the breweries that don't have restaurants attached and that don't have an automatic kind of food setup. So, you know, with breweries now that are open, they have to kind of already prepare ahead of time to have a food plan. So whether that's a food truck or a food vendor. And the other big sticking point that I heard across the board was the thing with the 24-hour reservation. So that's also new, and that also applies only to breweries.
What does that mean?
That means that people who are wanting to go to a brewery, whether it's Angel City, whether it's Frogtown, and I'm talking about a brewery that doesn't already have a restaurant attached, you have to get online and make a 24-hour reservation before you go in there. And that's a rule that has been really, from what I've been hearing, has really been a disadvantage to a lot of small breweries. For a few reasons, mainly because people will tend to make a reservation, but then not show up, right? So then the day of, you have, you know, maybe 50 people who made a reservation, only 20 of those people show up. What do you do with the other 30 spots? Meanwhile, you have a line of people who just kind of showed up, you know, hey, the brewery's open, let's go have a drink. And breweries, especially breweries who have been hit hard, most of them have, who have been shut down for the last 3 months, who've not had any other form of revenue, are in the position now of having to turn potential customers away because they did not make a 24-hour reservation.
So why the 24-hour rule? What is that supposed to do? Is that supposed to limit the amount of customers inside at any one time?
Allegedly. I mean, some of the people I spoke to said that a lot of it had to do with the county saying, we don't want people hanging out, waiting for a line, you know, waiting in line to get into your brewery. The idea was if people had a reservation, they show up, boom, they don't have to wait in line. They're at their seat.
I see. But why are they allowed to be inside drinking at all then? Because if bars aren't allowed to have customers inside, why do breweries get to have them inside?
Well, here's the rub. There is still no indoor drinking allowed at breweries. The breweries that have been able to kind of adapt best to opening are the ones that have been able to open up outdoors and have not only the outdoor open air setup with plenty of social distancing, but they also have food available, whether that's a food truck or their kitchen has opened up, like in the case of Progress and South Imani, or that they have a food vendor already kind of, you know, set up to offer food there. So,
and what is the idea behind that? Why do you have to have food in order to order a drink? Why is that a new rule?
Apparently right now it has to do with the kinds of, you know, the restaurants that are already open have been able to serve beer and alcohol kind of thing, you know, with food. And even the breweries that have had restaurants attached to them, for example, you know, something like Highland Park that has a kitchen or Arts District has a kitchen, they've never had to shut down because they've already been able to offer food. So if the county and the governor rule is around, like, you have to have food, or you have to be able to sell a food item in order to have an alcoholic beverage, that then had to apply. That was one of the rules that the breweries had to comply with in order to be able to open up
for their outdoor spaces.
And what counts as food? Could a bag of potato chips count?
From what I can tell, there are a lot of the regulations, especially because this news was kind of a surprise coming from the county, that the breweries and the wineries were allowed to be open, that followed with, you know, what does it mean then to have a food item? There are some breweries that still don't quite know how to address this or what that means, you know. So, you know, a lot of breweries are playing it safe by making sure that customers can order, you know, not just a bag of chips, right, like a plate of food or something like that.
Are some of these breweries retooling for delivery, like offering little mini kegs to go or growlers and things like that?
Exactly. In fact, a lot of them, you know, when the first kind of shutdown happened back in March, and then when the second shutdown happened, you know, it was open for a little while, and then it shut all back down again for some places in late June. This is where you see a lot of the small breweries moving to canning only. And there are some breweries right now that are simply producing for canning, right, for distribution, for pickup. A lot of breweries that have produced kegs, and, you know, they produced them, say, back in February, and then the shutdown happened in March. There are some breweries that told me they're going to have to start dumping kegs of beer because they couldn't sell their product. So a lot of them that are been able to can have been able to kind of squeak by and survive. But at the same time, there's a backup, as you can imagine, on raw materials like canning, like the cans themselves. Yeah. And one person, you know, one brewer told me that it's all up to a month wait sometimes to get cans. So because of that backlog, you know, there's a ripple effect on sort of, you know, who gets to get to the canning first. You know, do you have a plan to get your cans, you know, kind of a thing, you know, before. And so that becomes a concern before even, you know, how do we sell our beer, you know.
Oh, my gosh. I know. It all just makes you want to have a drink.
To be clear, you know, the breweries in and around LA County that are open, you know, they want your support. They're happy to be there. They need your support. And I think, you know, because there seems to be two clear, you know, ideas around this reservation system and you know, the requirement of having food, you know, while it benefits a lot of breweries, there are still, you know, quite a few that don't get to even take advantage of these new rules. So we'll see, you know, we hope that some of them survive. And LA is just sort of, you know, we're not like San Diego County or we're not like the Bay Area who have been established. You know, part of it, I think, too, is that the LA County Board of Supervisors, they don't quite understand the unique culture of the brewery or the economic or brewery economics, right? So I think part of the reason why the Brewers Guild had to you know, lobby the county was to kind of make the county aware of the uniqueness of this particular kind of business, that a lot of these businesses are small businesses, they're family owner operated, and that at the end of the day, that they are a huge part of the fabric of a community.
That is so true. Well, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about this.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to do that.
That's Melissa Hidalgo. She writes the Dr. Beer Butch column for LA Taco. Well, speaking of community, you are a part of our community, and we are a part of your community here at KCRW. Public radio station doesn't get more community than that. And so part of that is supporting each other. And we're here for you day in and day out. We have been during this entire pandemic, before the pandemic, and we'll be here after the pandemic. You can count on us, and we need to count on you too. And we do that by asking you to support it, kcrw.com/join. And as we have seen in this economy, things dry up like sponsorship, businesses go out of business, and that means they have less advertising dollars to spend, and it trickles down to us. So we do rely on you now more than ever. If you can, please go to kcrw.com/join. There's a great incentive in there. There's a brand new 13-inch MacBook Air, a sweepstakes, and the winner will be drawn tomorrow at midnight. So get in on that. 800-600-KCRW. Coming up, birds are doing better during quarantine, as well as teenagers. We'll have that story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We've said it before, and we'll say it again. The coronavirus has upended everything. Now even bird calls in and around San Francisco, without the din of city noise, the song of the white-crowned sparrow has changed, and it's affected its behavior. It's made these birds sexier, researchers say. Yeah, sexier. We're going to hear how they've changed in just a moment and talk about what it means for the bird's evolution and conservation efforts with Jennifer Phillips. She's a postdoc fellow at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and her research was just published in the journal Science. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline. It's great to talk to you today.
Great to have you. Well, let's first hear the song of the white-crowned sparrow. And this was audio you recorded pre-pandemic back in 2016. So here's a bit of the sparrow. Okay, I can barely make out the bird there. What are we listening to?
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite territories because it's right next to the Golden Gate Bridge. And so you can hear the bird singing there, but what you mostly hear is the traffic going over the Golden Gate Bridge. So that dull roar and the kind of click-clack of cars going over the random tracks on the bridge really dominate that recording. And that's pretty typical of the San Francisco soundscape.
All right. And before we listen to the after, the recording that you made during this pandemic, tell me just why you decided to revisit this. What made you think, aha, I think I should see if their song has changed?
Yeah, well, I mean, I spent 4 years studying these birds between 2013 and 2016. So I was sitting at home, you know, I'd been quarantined for like a month, and I'm thinking, oh, I got to do something. I can at least go outside and record birds or record noise levels somewhere. And then Liz, my collaborator, called me and she said, I just saw a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge and it's totally empty. And I was like, I've been thinking the same thing. And so just having that, you know, we've been both thinking about this, we should try to see what's going on with our sparrows up in San Francisco, kind of clicked it together that, okay, we can actually do this and go see if they're changing their song in any way. Are they singing more? Are they singing less? Or how are they changing their behavior in general?
Okay, so let's listen. This is a recording you made in April. Okay, now I really hear the bird, front and center, and that's a very nice song. What's different in the song itself?
Yeah, so what people have kind of been seeing as or noticing during this pandemic is that they feel like they're hearing more birds or the birds are louder. But what actually is happening is because there's less background noise, because there's less traffic, it's actually quieter outside. And that means the birds can sing more quietly. And when they're not busy, you know, screaming at the top of their lungs, they can actually sing more complicated songs or what we call higher performance songs. So they're singing a wider range of notes and they're changing the way they sing their trills, the rate.
When you say higher performance, do you mean that they're better able to sing? Their song is sweeter?
Yeah, you could put it that way. Yeah, they have that sexier song. So the reason why, well, I guess some of my earlier work showed that these wider range of notes are sexier, basically. So it should be better at attracting a mate and defending a territory. So for this species, at least, it's the male that mostly sings, although females can sing as well. But what the males do is they kind of sit in the center of their territory and they're singing their song and they're saying, I'm here, this is my territory. So if a female's nearby, she can be like, oh yeah, that guy sounds pretty sexy. Maybe I'll go pair up with him. Or the guy next door is like, oh yeah, he sounds pretty tough. I'm not going to go mess with him. I'm not going to go start a fight. The problem is when it's noisy, like the normal background noise in San Francisco, is the males often can't really assess each other from far away. So they end up having to come closer and potentially cause more fights to be able to assess each other based on that performance.
So is there less sparrow violence now?
Well, I would guess so. That's what I would guess, yeah. We haven't done a playback experiment to show that specifically yet, but that would be my hypothesis, is that when they can get a clear signal across, there's less conflict between territorial males.
That sounds like you could extrapolate that to a lot of animals, including the human animal.
Yeah, definitely. It could probably apply, be anthropomorphized to many different species.
Yeah. And also, I guess, along the same lines of reasoning, you could assume that they would be more prolific making babies if their song is more attractive.
Yes, that's something we hope to follow up with in the coming years, is look at these birds. So these young birds that were born this year in 2020, if they heard songs that were high performance, how is that going to affect them next year when they're trying to get their first territories? Are they going to be able to get territories if it's loud now? And are they going to be able to attract mates or not? So there's a lot of questions we can kind of jump to and follow up with to see whether these songs go back to what they were or if some males are now mismatched with their soundscape.
I wonder if less noise would also lure quieter birds back to the city. Like, I don't know if the sparrow is known to be a loud talker, but it seems like if they thrive in a city like San Francisco, they must like talking loudly at the top of their lungs because they haven't left yet. But what about other birds who may have said, you know, I can't deal with this. I got to go to a quieter place. Would they maybe be lured back?
Yeah, that's also a really interesting idea. And I think that's kind of where we can start thinking about conservation solutions for birds that maybe used to be in the city that we don't really see very often anymore. So the California quail is one bird that might be in a few deep pockets of some parks, but they are not seen very often anymore in San Francisco. So birds, and those are birds that have lower pitched calls. So the lower the pitch of the call, the more likely that bird is to be masked by low frequency noise like car traffic. So that's one hypothesis for why maybe some of those more sensitive birds are not common in the city anymore or aren't there at all. So if we reduce traffic noise, we might actually see some birds return.
So when all this is over and humans go back to commuting, or at least being out and about more and there's more traffic, do you think these sparrows will change their voices back?
Yeah, I think amplitude will adjust accordingly. You know, they've shown that flexibility. It's the performance for that I'm not sure about. And that's what our future studies will hopefully find some answers to. And one of our earlier studies did show that the urban sparrows are more flexible than the rural sparrows. So the sparrows out in Marin County, when we've played noise at them, they did not adjust. But maybe these birds that have persisted in San Francisco have just a different, you know, phenotype where they're able to be a little bit more flexible because they've faced so many different pressures of changing noise levels.
Well, it's true with humans, right? That when you live in a noisy environment, you just get used to it and you adjust and you don't even notice it anymore.
Exactly.
You don't even realize you're shouting when you're shouting.
Right. I mean, don't they say that about New Yorkers? Like they talk faster and
louder.
They're more aggressive. And that's kind of what we see in sparrows in San Francisco, too. So there's definitely parallels.
I'm flying here. Okay. Jennifer Phillips, postdoc fellow at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's great talking to you.
Yeah, and thanks for sticking with us even through my really bad Midnight Cowboy impersonation there. This is the end of the show, but it is not the end of our fundraiser. We are still in the midst of it, and we need you to go online or go to the phone and become a member or renew your membership at 800-600-5279 or kcrw.com/join. Yeah, the pandemic has been really hard for all of us, for some of us more than others. If you are someone who has been fortunate enough not to have suffered too much financially, then perhaps you could kick it up a little bit and contribute for someone who hasn't been able to contribute. Contribute for someone who has suffered financially and do this for them. kcrw.com/join. And if you do, you'll be automatically entered to win our sweepstakes, a brand new 13-inch MacBook Air. So count yourself in. kcrw.com/give. 800-600-KCRW. 800-600-5279. Lots of great goodies there at the website for you to choose as a thank you gift as well, including a contribution to the LA or Santa Barbara Regional Food Bank. So your dollar can go twice as far to two needy organizations, the Food Bank and KCRW. All right, you know what to do. kcrw.com/join. Now's the time to do it. Do not delay. We really, 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 really need you. All right, that's it for me. Have a great rest of your day. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.